WLRN Edition 96. Broadcasting in 3, 2, 1.
I was born woman. Off my knees, I will stand for my liberation. Sisters, rise again. I was born woman. Off my knees, I will stand for my liberation. Rise and rise again.
Greetings and welcome to the 96th edition podcast of Women's Liberation Radio News for this Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm Thistle Pedersen, biological reality and bicycle enthusiast. This month's edition focuses on our world of increasing dangers due to environmental destruction and man-made climate change. Earth Day is coming up on April 22nd, and we wanted to reflect on what it means to be alive on the planet after living through the hottest year on record and going into another year sure to be full of its own catastrophes. We're doing things a bit differently this month and skipping the interview. Instead, we'll hear in-house commentaries on the topic from WLRN members Sekhmet Sheowl, Emily Fay, Jocelyn Crawley, Aurora Linnea, and yours truly. The team at WLRN produces a monthly radio broadcast to break the sound barrier women are blocked by under the status quo rule of men. This blocking of women's discourse we see in all sectors of society, be they conservative, liberal, mainstream, progressive, or radical. The thread that runs through all of American politics, except for separatist feminism, is male dominance and entitlement in all spheres. To start off today's edition, here's Mary O'Neill with women's news from around the globe for this Thursday, April 4th, 2024.
Thanks, Thistle. France has become the first country in the world to include a woman's right to abortion in its constitution. Abortion was legalized in France in 1975, and around 85% of the French population supported enshrining it as a constitutional amendment. Prime Minister Gabriel Attal told Parliament before the vote, "We're sending a message to all women. Your body belongs to you, and no one can decide for you." In Canada, the Supreme Court declared in a March 8th sexual assault ruling that the choice of the trial judge to use the words "a woman" may have been unfortunate and engendered confusion. In 2020, Justice Michael Tamman had found Christopher James Crook guilty of rape, but in 2022, an appeals court overruled Crook's conviction, asserting that Tamman had engaged in speculative reasoning. While the Supreme Court decided that Tamman's judgment was ultimately sound, it apparently felt the need to chastise Tamman for recognizing biological reality. In India, 7 men attacked a Spanish couple and gang-raped the woman. Police detained 3 men and were searching for 4 others involved in the attack. Since they could not find a hotel, the couple had been camping when they were attacked. They posted a video on Instagram describing what they suffered, but the video has since been removed. Rape remains a massive problem in India, with over 31,000 cases reported in 2022 alone. The UK Vagina Museum sought permission from filmmaker Nina Paley to screen her film Cedar Masochism. She decided to deny permission, explaining, "How can I, as a woman, work with organizations that cancel women? I would be working against myself and my sisters." She went on to say, "Organizations can support women by acknowledging the definition of women, adult human females. Until they do so, any claims to support women are meaningless." Despite being a museum dedicated to female anatomy, the Vagina Museum has removed female-centric language from its website and exhibits. Experts with the Nutrition Center, which is a partnership that includes the UN and Save the Children, warn that nearly 230,000 new mothers and children in Sudan are at risk of starvation in the months ahead. Since intense fighting began in April 2023, more than 10 million have had to flee their homes. It is estimated that 729,000 children under 5 years old suffer from severe acute malnutrition. The country director for Save the Children in Sudan, Dr. Arif Noor, said the country's food insecurity is one of the worst in the world. The center also estimates that 1.2 million pregnant and breastfeeding women will suffer from malnutrition this year, which puts them at risk of significant health issues and death. Leaked files from the World Professional Association of Transgender Health indicate that clinicians violated medical ethics and understood that their patients, often children and teenagers, did not understand the consequences of treatment. The files show that teenagers, some with other mental health conditions and developmental delays, have been allowed to consent to hormonal treatments and body-altering surgeries. Michael Schellenberger, president of Environmental Progress, which first published the leak files, said the so-called gender-affirming care they provide can result in lifelong complications and sterility, and that their patients do not understand the implications, such as loss of sexual function. A talk to commemorate International Women's Day, given by Alice Sullivan, entitled "Why Do We Need Data on Sex and Gender Identity?" was canceled by Canada's Department of Justice. Sullivan, the head of research at the University College London Social Research Institute, told the Daily Telegraph that her talk was canceled without notice or explanation. In Canada, data is collected based on gender rather than sex, and since 2021, people are able to select an option other than their sex. In a statement provided to the Telegraph, the Department of Justice said it canceled a proposed internal event that was meant to mark International Women's Day in favor of promoting a whole-of-government event offered by the Canada School of Public Service that aligns more closely with the theme of the International Women's Day 2024 of investing in women and accelerating progress. Metro Maran, a gender and policy advisor with a think tank called the Atlantic Council, asked the UN to criminalize the Taliban's policies in Afghanistan as gender apartheid. She told the UN, "Women in Afghanistan have been on the streets for the past 2.5 years, accepting bullets, lashes, arbitrary arrest, imprisonment, torture, and even death." Ms. Maran herself fled the Taliban, but she continues to devote her life to fighting for the rights of her fellow women. The Taliban announced that it would resume flogging and stoning women to death in public for adultery. Safia Arifia, lawyer and head of Women's Window of Hope, said, "Now, no one is standing beside them to save them from Taliban punishments. The international community has chosen to remain silent in the face of these violations of women's rights." Sahar Fatrat, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, said of the Taliban, "They tested their draconian policies one by one and have reached this point because there is no one to hold them accountable for the abuses. Through the bodies of Afghan women, the Taliban demand and command moral and societal orders. We should all be warned that if not stopped, more and more will come." On International Women's Day, Indigenous women marched in Puyo, Ecuador, as they do every year, to demonstrate for women's rights. To quote Glenda Yasakama, a Shuar woman, "Marcho por la vida, por estar aquí, por todas las mujeres, por si un día no estoy, quiero que las demás marchen también por mí." I march for life, to be here, for women, and if one day I'm not here, I want others to march for me too. That concludes WLRN's World News segment for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. I'm Mary. Share your news stories, announcements, and tips with us by emailing info@wlrnmedia.com and letting us know what's going on.
This is Joe Brew, and you are listening to WLRN.
Excluding all the expensive ones.
There's mass confusion in the forest. I heard about it on the radio. So they're bringing in some guy and he's gonna go on and on about all the things that he don't know. And there's some girl in the background, she's screaming something about missing trees. And I'm wondering, where did they go? No lines on the highway, no paths. passing, they say, no green to my left and no green to my right. And the man behind the axe always gets a full meal, cause green never puts up much of a fight. So here's some helpful hints, some rather shared pins for a beautiful grace. And we steal their space and death comes quickly. So I pull up to my double car garage hideaway and I start to say, where did all the trees go?
That was Tegan and Sarah with their song, Our Trees. Earth Day is coming up on April 22nd, a day to recognize the work to heal our Mother Earth. In recognition of this day, we invited our members to write up commentaries to weave into a tapestry of WLRN perspectives and views this April 2024 on planet Earth. The effort to establish Earth Day began in 1969 when a Wisconsin junior senator who, along with the rest of the country, watched as a 3 million gallon oil spill devastated the Santa Barbara coast and its wildlife. Through bipartisan effort, the strategy for Earth Day was modeled after the peace movement, and thus was planned a nationwide consciousness-raising campus teach-in for April 22nd. Earth Day 1969 was a success and led to a swath of environmental legislation in the years that followed. It also was successful in uniting Americans across party lines for the purpose of protecting the planet from the ravages of industrialization. Roughly 20 million Americans took to the streets in support of Earth Day, recognizing that the health of the planet trumps politics. Here now is Sekhmet Shiyawal, starting us off with her commentary. After Sekhmet's, we'll hear from Emily Fay, Jocelyn Crowley, Aurora Linnea, and Thistle Patterson. Listen for Thistle's song Bike Lane, an ode to phoenixes rising from the ash and gardens returning.
Women need the earth, but the earth doesn't need us. By this I mean, if human beings disappeared tomorrow, the natural world would not only survive, but thrive. At this point, the Earth is more likely to recover from all the damage human beings have done if we did somehow disappear. But people, women, cannot survive without the Earth intact. Our relationship with nature has never been equal or symbiotic. It's a relationship of one-sided dependence, with us being the dependent party. Remembering that fact should humble us. Without that humility, it's easy to take the earth for granted, to believe we can put it through anything and suffer no consequences, to forget how vulnerable we are without nature's support system. It isn't just greed and violence and a destructive nature that leads the most powerful men in the patriarchy to abuse and wreck the earth. It is their arrogance. The arrogance of believing they themselves can survive without the natural world. And it isn't just our physical survival we owe to the earth. As women, we owe so much of our mental health, our emotional stability, our resilience in the face of male oppression and terrorism to nature. The time we spend outside, feeling the sun on our skin, breathing the air, walking through forests or hiking up mountains, looking at the sky, feeling the grass under our bare feet. It's healing, nurturing, comforting. It helps us regulate our dysregulated nervous systems. It helps us forget painful pasts and stop worrying about a future we can never fully control. The Earth is this beautiful, awe-inspiring thing that no amount of human suffering, no amount of male violence and sexual predation can ever fully eclipse. For thousands of years, women have suffered on this earth at the hands of men. How many moments have there been throughout all that history where women and girls found, even if temporarily, some kind of peace simply by connecting with nature? How often have we been able to draw strength, resilience, power, and hope from the earth? It's no coincidence that the majority of environmental activists have always been women. And while the long-term outlook of our Earth isn't good, while we are limited in our ability to combat patriarchy's ecological destruction, I'm proud of us for fighting. I'm proud of us for caring as deeply as we do, for each act individual women and girls perform to show the Earth love, gratitude, and respect.
When I was growing up, my mother taught my brothers and me to turn the water off while we were brushing our teeth, and turn the lights off if we weren't in the room, and to take short showers so as not to waste water. We recycled, and my mom had a special contraption for drying freshly washed Ziploc bags. An ever-present looming climate disaster has always been a part of my conscious mind. Once, when I was in high school, I got into a screaming fight with my best friend after she threw a banana peel out of the car window while we were driving on the highway. "How could you?" I bellowed at her. "How could you be a litter bug?" She laughed at me, said I was overreacting and being ridiculous, that banana peels are biodegradable and it would break down on the side of the road. I remember the panic and guilt that washed over me as I kept driving, fighting the impulse to pull over on the highway and walk back to find the banana peel. Why would she do something like that? Hadn't she learned about littering in elementary school? Hadn't she seen that Native American man crying on the mountain of trash? We never spoke about the fight again and continued to be friends. But my view of her had been altered. She was bad now. She had done something bad. She had littered, and littering was bad and wrong, and now she, too, was bad and wrong in my mind. After high school, I moved to New York City, where it was even more uncool to care about things. Growing up, I had felt the weight of responsibility to stop the climate disaster. I felt I could, that we all could recycle enough to stop it from happening. But in New York City, my friend's attitude was not my fucking problem. But I could never help myself from clicking on headlines promising to teach me 10 new ways to be more environmentally friendly in my everyday life. But I was always disappointed to find the tips were things I already did or couldn't do because I was poor. Where were the next 10 tips I could follow? What if I already was washing my Ziploc bags and never buying bottled water? What if I already lived in a densely populated apartment building and took public transportation? The truth was, doing the behaviors did not alleviate the ever-present sense of doom like I wanted it to, and oftentimes I found the rigidity of my actions alienated me from my friends. It just wasn't cool to bring my friend's recycling home in my purse for proper disposal. Then one afternoon, I was sitting in the cafe at Whole Foods, and I watched a worker collecting trash from the many differently labeled bins and putting them all into the same bag. Was it all a lie? Why would Whole Foods have brightly colored bins for food scraps, plastics, glass, paper, and landfill, if it was all going to landfill? In one lunchtime, I became just as jaded and cynical as all my other New York friends. It doesn't matter. My actions don't matter. And I cannot stop the climate disaster with recycling. I still try my best not to be wasteful, to buy in bulk when I can to reduce plastic, but more so to save money. Most importantly, I stopped thinking of myself as a good person for doing the right things and other people as bad for doing the wrong things. The frenzied thoughts of judgment I had against people who weren't building their lives around environmentalism stopped and were replaced with compassion and curiosity. Most people are just trying their best every day and being fed corporate propaganda that makes stopping the climate disaster caused by multi-billion dollar companies my personal anxiety doesn't help me and it doesn't help Mother Earth. For this Earth Day, I ask our sisters to research the companies that are collecting your household waste and learn exactly what actually gets recycled there, and stop putting items that these companies are not able to recycle in your bin at home. Most recycling companies in the United States are only capable of recycling type 1 and 2 plastics, so it is much better to put numbers 3 through 7 and anything that has a recyclable symbol on it, but no number, into the trash. The latest dirty trick these companies are playing on us is by putting the recycling symbol on things that are not at all recyclable. This and the so-called wishful recycling of well-meaning environmentalists causes more harm than good in our current system. The best we can do is band together and hold male-led companies accountable for hundreds of years of willfully and recklessly destroying our wilderness and waterways for profit, and stop judging and criticizing each other.
Hey, it's Jocelyn, the newest member of our WLRN Collective. As 2024 continues to unfold, I find myself experiencing immense gratitude as a yogi and feminist who recognizes that everything, particularly the material reality of the female body and life itself, is immensely sacred. At the same time that I experience deep gratitude for being able to recognize the immense beauty and intricate complexity of the living world, I'm also grateful that I'm able to take an honest look at aspects of existence that reflect inclinations toward death, disorientation, and the disquietude which results from recognizing destructive, recidivistic realities unfold in contexts which could be progressive and constructive. As radicals know, the contemporary world order is predicated upon the necrotic, nefarious regime of patriarchy, and the malevolent, malicious activity of this male-led regime impacts every aspect of life, including the environment. Recognizing the intersections of patriarchy and the destruction of the environment is disheartening, but individuals who are committed to practicing genuine empathy and awareness for the purpose of cultivating higher consciousness and meaningful, knowledge-based existence can benefit from recognizing the relationship between male domination and the death of the planet. That patriarchy is predicated on and includes evaluation of toxic masculinity as a viable modality through which to experience life is clear. What some may be shocked or intrigued to know is that the principle of toxic masculinity, which is predicated upon men believing that they have to reject attitudes, actions, and associations which are deemed confluent with femininity and femaleness, permeates the realm of environmental destruction. For example, research demonstrates that women leave a less substantive carbon footprint, recycle more, and litter less than men. The team of researchers who began from this premise sought to discover whether men have a greater antipathy towards environmentally conscious behavior and, if this is the case, why. The researchers, recorded in an article called "Masculinity is Killing the Planet," questioned 2,000 participants in China and the U.S. to determine whether they would categorize various products and actions as feminine or masculine. According to the study, the men were more likely to view environmentally friendly products and actions as feminine. At the same time, the men were more likely to select environmentally malevolent products and harmful activities as a modality through which to assert their masculinity. In one experiment, participants saw a gift card with a floral design and were instructed to imagine using this pink gift card to buy something. According to the study's findings, men who saw the card were more likely to imagine buying a product that was bad for the environment than men who were shown a neutral gift card. Another experiment found that both women and men asserted that using single-use plastic bags in a store setting is masculine, while utilizing a reusable grocery bag in a store setting is feminine. While this article went on to make many more intriguing assertions which reveal the interconnected nature of toxic masculinity and environmental destruction, what I found most compelling was researchers suggesting that, in light of the information found in the aforementioned studies, a potential solution would be to incorporate marketing strategies that use fonts and colors more traditionally associated with masculinity to entice men to be more environmentally friendly. Here, I see what I have come to conclude is a prototypical response to the realization that patriarchy dominates and individuals who live within the system of domination must learn how to operate within it. This prototypical response, whether intentionally or unwittingly, sustains patriarchy by asserting that individuals who operate within realms of domination must learn how to accommodate oppressors by subtly or saliently shifting systems such that their shape and form is confluent with or conducive to the existing system of hierarchical valuation of men and devaluation of women. in this case, to counter the male proclivity to demonstrate hostility and harm towards the living world as an assertion of their manhood, individuals who hope that men will stop operating in a malevolent capacity must encourage them to demonstrate environmental sensitivity in ways that subtly reinforce their masculinity. The dissociating environmental concern from fonts and colors that are traditionally associated with femininity is a prerequisite to prompting men to engage in the preservation of the natural world, privileges members of the master class, men, within a system in which they are already experiencing substantive privileges. Therefore, the process of accommodating the oppressor within this context of attempting to engage men in the process of experiencing empathy towards a living world only strengthens the regime of patriarchal domination by ensuring that prototypically toxic masculinist ways of relating to the environment gain primacy and prevalence. At the same time, the valuation of prototypically masculine ways of relating to the environment is a form of female erasure, which involves obscuring or displacing signifiers of femininity, whether those include floral imagery, pink coloring, or other visual motifs, and thereby reinforces the devaluation of women and the feminine as fundamentally inferior or mutable to the superior and permanently present nature of maleness. The necrotic, nefarious nature of the patriarchy is reinforced in other thought worlds, including the work of Ali L. Benares and her important article, Let's Heal the Planet by Letting Go of the Patriarchy. In this article, Benares explains that historically, egalitarian principles gave shape and substance to the way men and women interacted, such that equality rather than domination and submission impacted the ecology of the environment. Benares explains that matriarchal principles were once integral to the world's operations, such as the valuation of community, compassion, and cooperation gave shape and substance to the socialization process. In studies of hunter-gatherers, the division of labor unfolded such that members of both sexes brought in a similar range of calories for their communities. The approach to allocating resources was more communal, and the relationship between children and parents was more profound. Although the time frame and underlying causes of the devolution from interactive and contributive cooperation to the patriarchal principles of domination is still unclear, that we currently exist within a male-led system of hierarchy in which men have more power and this unequal distribution of agency actively harms women and the planet is plain. As noted by Benares, the modern world was marked by a transition into a similarly selfish and aggressive patriarchal society, has led to the accumulation of resources which has spiraled into deforestation, global pollution, wars, and consumerism to the point of eventual self-destruction. That this devaluation of the planet is directly linked to the patriarchy is often a marginalized aspect of discussions regarding the environment, but Benares is prudent in identifying the destruction of the living world within the context of male rule, because understanding the underlying causes of the problem, or getting to the root of things as radicals like to do, is a precursor to resolving or at least understanding the nature, depth, and scope of the dire situation. If one agrees to the assertion that matriarchal societies maintained a deeper commitment to egalitarian communal ways of relating to both people and the planet, it seems that the revivification of social systems predicated on matriarchy, rather than the support for or denial of the prevalence of patriarchal principles adversely impacting the environment, is a tenable solution for environmental degradation. Let's consider how men consistently view both the environment and women as elements of the object world which they can subordinate and consume for their own perverse pleasures. The objectification of women transpires in a plethora of contexts, including but not limited to pornography, prostitution, and surrogate motherhood, while the objectification of the living world transpires through processes such as the displacement of animals from their natural habitat and hunting expeditions which culminate in the depiction of murdered animals as products for sale in the form of bullhorns and buffalo skulls on websites. When considered carefully, I continually construe the patriarchal system of domination as reflective of principles reinforcing separation, with this process involving the construction of the world in terms of first, defining some beings as subjects and others as objects, and second, determining that the subjects, men, have the right to determine what happens to the objects, women, animals, and all other aspects of the living world. People all over the world, particularly women, are offering tenable solutions for the horrors and atrocities created by patriarchy, and one concept I found particularly intriguing was that of integral ecology. Integral ecology is a view that everything in the universe is interconnected, and I think that this principle of connectivity is more likely to precipitate empathy towards other beings, thereby challenging and potentially even eradicating the principle of otherness designed by patriarchy to ensure that some individuals' ideas and institutions are naturalized as ideal and included, while others are rejected as inferior, valueless, or undesirable. The feeling, sense, and material reality of separation engendered by patriarchy precipitates the normalization of environmental abuse, and conversely, the principle of integral ecology, or this emphasis on recognizing the connection between everything, can likely enable individuals to view themselves as a part of, rather than separate from and above, the natural world. If the principle of integral ecology becomes central to human consciousness, the potential for cooperative coexistence with the natural world might reverse much of the environmental damage engendered by patriarchal principles. That is my hope.
I was a young girl when the shame crept in, the sour, chronic twinge of my remorse for being a person. Humans are a blight on the earth. I thought we are a disease, malignant and malign, like parasites. We eat up everything beautiful and vital and seep our poison ugliness into what remnant we leave alive so it wastes away in anguish, gnawed and degraded. That's what humans do. That's how humans are, I told myself. And I am blameworthy because I'm a human too. I was horror-struck by the razing of forests, by the government execution of wolves, and the number of manatees killed by speedboats each year in Florida, by sea turtles disfigured by plastic soda rings, by Arctic drilling, oil spills, by housing developments and sprawling landfills, by farms like death camps full of tortured animals bred only to be killed and eaten, by people's indifference for the chipmunks and squirrels they'd crush so casually, with their hateful cars, never stopping, never caring. And I knew I was part of the problem, because I was born a person. Worse yet, I'd been born in America, meaning I was part of the society most unforgivably responsible for every single one of these atrocities. I was implicated, and I was ashamed. My great plan to save the world, conceived at the age of 8 and presented to my father with the somber, earnest gravity of an agonized child, was that we humans had to do ourselves in at once to release the wounded earth from our cruelties. Despite the entirely reasonable, measured critiques my father raised in answer to my proposal, the most compelling for me at that time being the hitch that if everyone who cared about the earth offed themselves, only careless people would remain, so everything would get even worse. I maintained for years, well into young womanhood, that voluntary auto-extermination was the sole, truly sensible, long-term solution to the humanity crisis. Only when we are gone will the earth be able to heal, I thought. I was sure the world would be better off without me. The wolves, the woods, the oceans, the flower fields, the moon-color moths, the orange-spined newts, even the soil, delicious like dark cake in its wet-scented blackness, would be better off. Everything and everyone I loved would be better off without me. I was sure of it. Often enough, I stumble into days when I feel this way still, and indeed, there is a documentary that I adore, and which I watch a few times a year when I'm feeling desperate for reassurance. It's called Radioactive Wolves of Chernobyl, and it's about the blossoming back of the wilds in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. Since the nuclear reactor exploded there in 1986, humans have been forbidden from living in that place. And because there are no humans, in spite of the technically lethal radiation, all other species have flourished. Bison, wild horses, catfish, wolves, dormice, hawks and cranes, ferns, the brilliant golden reeds spindling through the walls of rotted cabins. If I'm being honest, this film is one of the few things that gives me real, unsentimental, rugged-boned hope, a hope I can dig my fingers into, chew on, not that floppy pastel saccharine hope where force-fed is anesthetic. It reminds me of the tenacity of life's will to continue living. The living earth is so much vaster and wiser in its cyclical ancientness than we are capable of grasping, and though we are harming it hideously, and though it will shift forms in response to the violence that we inflict, we will never destroy it. It's a kind of hubris, really, to think that we could. To paraphrase Rachel Carson, the war that we wage against nature is, in reality, a war waged against ourselves, for we will be the ultimate casualties. Soon enough, the earth will shake us off and move on. Ever disloyal to my species, the deep grace of this truth is precious to me. Yet, although I have zero hope for human society in its current iteration, I'm no longer ashamed to be human. Since becoming a feminist, I've learned that humanity, per se, is not the plague. This society that brutalizes the earth is not human society, generally speaking, but rather patriarchal society, the man-made system that has plundered, oppressed, and murdered its way to global dominance over the last 5,000 odd years. Life's enemy is this industrial civilization, the kingdom of the fathers. It is millennia of male rule that have driven us to the state of ecological breakdown already underway. Women did not author nor engineer the ecocidal civilization, though to avoid slipping into theories of biological supremacy, we're obliged to recall that we can't say for certain we would not have had we been at the helm. Still, the fact remains, we did not make society what it is today. Our class did not. As participants in it, we are inevitably complicit in its destructiveness, but we neither devised nor initiated the massacre. Knowing this, I no longer lobby for the great human die-off, that altruistic ushering in of our extinction. Instead, my heartsick devotion to the earth and its creatures I have repurposed to serve as engine for my dedication to the feminist movement, the struggle to rip patriarchy clawed out by its envenomed root. Because I see now that the solution to ecocide is to end male dominion. Feminism, as I understand and as I practice it, is an urgent response to the patriarchal atrocity complex, in defense not only of all women, but of all beings, of life itself. Every move we make to resist and to undermine patriarchal civilization, to tear it down, to disarm it, is an act of kindness and care for the living earth. And through our actions, we begin to redeem ourselves as human beings. I believe this now. My shame is thinning. I long to see what we might become after the fall of man. For the first time, sisters, I think maybe I could love my own species.
For this Earth Day 2024 edition, I began looking back on my lifespan and I realized I was born into the knowledge that man had the violent power to kill his own habitat and his own Mother Earth. Earth Day was founded in the USA in 1970, 2 years after I was born. I was born into environmental doomsdayisms. I graduated from high school in 1986 at a time when both nuclear destruction and environmental disasters were imminent. These threats continue into today's world, but even more so, looming large on the horizon with stranger and stranger cloud formations and fronts rolling in. Despair is the curtain hanging in my window. I pull it back and see the brown, dead grass and a slanted winter sky, but no snow. Despair is the ground that goes up in flames because wildfire season comes earlier every year. My life, my corpse, my dreaded hopelessness come hither. I don't know what else to do but to accept and name what I see. Driving to work one morning this spring, I smell something strange, artificial smelling, burning my nostrils for a painful split second. My mind spirals into a fantasy of the air suddenly becoming unbreathable. All of us in our cars on this highway, spinning out of control and then burning up in flames, producing even more black smoke and poisonous, unbreathable air. But is this a fantasy? The longer I live, the more disasters, war, and suffering I observe due to male-led negligence, aggression, and nonchalance towards certain peoples and the living earth. Is it a fantasy, or am I tapping into my intuitive knowledge that something is very wrong these days? I feel the warning in my blood, my ancestral DNA sounding an alarm every day as we continue to teeter on the edge of chaos and black smoke. I wait for the phoenix to rise in my waking dream, but there is only charred flesh and corpses that remain on the horizon. I continue my drive to work, leaving behind my blink of an eye fantasy, but holding the memory of it just beneath the surface of my consciousness. The myth of the phoenix carries me forward with the knowledge that our ash will cover the seeds we planted, that will regrow gardens and even forests after we're gone. Without death, there is no life. There is a great roundness, a circular cycle to life, and it is something we can all tap into as the earth rebirths herself through fire. Yet I continue to despair not only for the four-leggeds, the mosses, budding trees, and birds aflight, but for humanity, ourselves. Yes, some form of life will exist after our extinction, but we won't be there to see it, to make art about it, to dance and sing about it. And the pathways to our extinction are so bloody, so horrific and painful, that it feels impossible to process. Because I am human, and it is through my eyes that I see the world, it's very challenging to let go of the form of life we took on this planet, and to know and understand that men used this form to destroy not only ourselves, but multiple other earthly life forms that live here too. What a grave misuse of our amazing hand and opposable thumb. Our fingers and hands should be in wet clay, making sculptures and pots, not on guns, swords, and nuclear arsenals. Let's just say that a lot of painful energy has been created, and that we must feel it and transform it in the old ways of alchemy and earth magic to break free. I have to work through my despair every single day to get out the door in the morning, and at times it overwhelms me, and I just carry it around with me all day until a moment of song or dance brings me back into the room. And let us not forget, it's the idea of male supremacy enforced by male violence that lies at the root of killing the earth. Male dominion is why we need radical feminism, to name the problem and begin banding together for comfort and potential solutions rising from the grassroots. This last song is one I wrote while on a musical bike tour with another musician from the Riot Folk Collective in 2005 in the Pacific Northwest. We were riding down the coast when Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana. This was a time when the crisis of peak oil and gas was publicized by politicians like Al Gore. Soon after getting the news of the hurricane hitting New Orleans, we began to see gas prices go up in Oregon. While getting my bike fixed at a gas station in a little town called Tiller, my folk musician companion wanted to write a song about the hurricane, so we both got out our guitars and wrote our respective songs. About a year later, I recorded mine in the studio with a bass player and guitarist. The lyrics paint a picture of what it felt like to be riding bicycles on a busy road full of cars, but with no other bicycles present despite the paint on the asphalt of a white bicycle, denoting our little lane to the right of all the motor vehicles. Here's my song, Bike Lane.
Clear shoulder where no bicycle storm, how it moves so fast. But would it have happened if we didn't burn gas? If we weren't destroying the climate and the air, would there be some hope to get beyond this despair? Cause this bike lane, like social change, is too little. It's too late. Bike breaks down in a town called Tiller. Local stock and gas prices, money's also a killer. The systems it's created, if you'd asked me before, oil was always outdated. Think of all of those who've died, and now the climate refugees, poor and black people again on their knees. In the state of Texas, Bush's homeland no less, poor people always pay the white man debt. And this bike lane, like social change, is too little. It's just too late. Cause the rich still have access to oil, only a few leave their cars. Streets, not afraid to look below at what lies beneath, rising up from the ash from a smoldering log, holding hands, lighting sounds, sifting through the fogs of our history and evolution. It's coming so fast, the end of oil economy, the end of our gas. But this bike lane, like social, human-powered and lean. And it's more fun than veggie oil-powered anything. So pick up an axe, chop the concrete, plant gardens in the earth you find beneath. But save some pavement for us, for our joy machines. Riding cross country, we'll plant our seeds. Till this bike lane, like social change, grows wider. And we fly, fly, fly.
You are listening to WLRN.
We the women remember. We the women are not afraid. We the women are relentless.
We the women are a phoenix. We the women rise from the ash. We the women plant seeds and nourish gardens of nettle and dandelion.
We the women sew and weave. We the women create tapestries of connection. We the women are the cloth.
We the women are getting stronger. We the women stand in solidarity.
We the women create. We the women support. We the women thrive.
We the women cast roots in rich soil. We the women lean together, blades of grass to make the meadow. We the women catch sun and flower.
We the women fight back. We the women love. We the women prevail.
We the women
will gather July 19th through the 21st in the Pacific Northwest.
Hi, this is Heather Scalzi, We the Women event organizer. Thank you to WLRN for promoting our event, sure to spark the fires of change in our women's movement for our sex-based rights. Come to the beautiful Pacific Northwest this summer over the weekend of July 19th through 21st. To get your ticket, visit wethewomen.world. That's wethewomen.world.
Thanks for listening to WLRN's 96th edition podcast, dedicated to our Mother Earth and Earth Day 2024. WLRN would like to thank our members this month for sharing their views and commentary on the state of the environment. Thank you so much, Sekhmet, Emily, Jocelyn, Aurora, and Thistle. Until next time, this is Jenna signing off on another WLRN podcast.
Hello, friends. This is Jocelyn signing in to state that the environment matters. Living beings matter. Women matter. And the earth matters. As feminists, recognizing the interconnected nature of all things, including the way that we treat the living world around us, resonates in my heart and soul for this amazing month. If you like what you are hearing and would like to donate to the cause of Feminist Community Radio, please visit our WordPress site and click on the donate button. Check out our merch tab to get a nice gift in exchange for your donation. And if you are interested in joining our team, we are always looking for new volunteers to conduct interviews, write blog posts, post to our Facebook and other social media pages, and do other tasks to keep us moving forward as a collective of media activist women. Thanks for listening. This is Jocelyn signing off for now.
And I am Thistle Pedersen. Thanks for tuning in. Next month, we'll focus our program on the Taylor Swift phenomenon. Our handcrafted podcasts always come out the first Thursday of the month, so look for it on Thursday, May 2nd. If you'd like to receive our newsletter that notifies you when each podcast, music show, and interviews are released, please sign up for our newsletter on the WLRN WordPress site. Stay strong in the struggle, and thanks for listening.
This is Aurora signing off on another edition of WLRN's monthly handcrafted podcast. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Spinster, Overit, and SoundCloud, in addition to our WordPress site. Thank you so very much for listening.
And this is Sekhmet She-Owl. Our monthly podcasts are always crafted with tender, loving care and in solidarity with women worldwide. Thanks for your support. We would love to hear from you, so please share, like, and comment widely.
But how will we find our way out of this? What is the antidote for the patriarchal kiss? How will we find what needs to be shown? And then after that, where is home? Tell me. My home. 'Cause gender hurts.